Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, news that an 11-week-old white-tailed sea eagle chick is the first female to fledge in Cork in over 100 years. We discover that the dung beetle and the mites that travel on its body are friends of the Irish farmer. And scientists observing from space have discovered new colonies of emperor penguins. But they fear that climate change could have an impact on their numbers.
Emperor penguins are going to be severely affected by global warming, we think. We've lost large swathes of sea ice in the Arctic. If this happens in the Antarctic, it will be catastrophic for the emperor penguins because they won't have that breeding platform for the stable for 9 months of the year. So we expect to lose a large percentage of the emperor penguin population. Projections at the moment suggest 80 or even more percentage than that.
Oh, can you just feel it? You can feel it coming across the airwaves. Can you feel it, Aina?
Yes, the cold air is coming out of the speakers.
We never had temperatures like that here in Ireland, did we?
Well, we didn't. I mean, it's minus 3 in Ireland in the wintertime. We're all nearly having a fit.
But Fado, during the last ice age.
The last ice age kind of came to an end. We had a warm period and the ice all melted off Greenland and places and the fresh water went into the sea and caused another ice age. So we kind of had a warming up bit and then it got really cold again and then it warmed up finally eventually. So we had kind of a false start, if you like. So the poor old giant Irish deer became extinct at that point. So it wasn't a good time for people then.
But what kind of temperatures are they experiencing in Antarctica?
Well, I don't know. I mean, are we talking in Fahrenheit or centigrade?
Celsius and centigrade, the same thing.
Yes, well, Celsius and centigrade. If it's minus 40, it's the same in both languages. But if it's colder than that, if it's minus 80 centigrade or Celsius, which is what it is down there, it's shocking cold.
Shocking cold. Could you imagine? How do birds, Niall Hatch, survive in such places?
Very few birds can, but the emperor penguin is one that can. But it's the only one that can. It survives the coldest temperatures of any animal on the planet. And it does that by having the most amazing insulation through its feathers and a layer of blubber or fat underneath that. So they just have to ride out that winter. They breed during the winter in Antarctica too. It's not even the summertime, it's the winter. So they endure darkness and cold like we couldn't even imagine.
But they've got to stand on the ice.
They do, yeah. And they have very limited blood flow in their feet to prevent losing heat that way. And they balance the eggs, of course, on their feet when they're doing that and keep them warm with the belly patch. It's the male that does this. The females are off out at sea. They go away for weeks, even months on end, catching fish. And the male just stands there, no food at all, just has to huddle with all the other males, keeping the eggs and the chicks warm.
How come his feet don't freeze to the ice?
Because, well, it's actually very dry there. There's actually no water. To actually freeze solid, you'd have to melt the ice, first of all. But it's too cold for that even to happen. There's so little temperature escaping or so little heat escaping through his feet, there's never any liquid water down there at all. So it doesn't freeze solid.
Well, I'm looking forward to that story later on. The story that from outer space, scientists using satellites have been able to observe new colonies of emperor penguins in Antarctica. But as you heard there from that clip, they worry for their numbers with climate change. Now, some of you, I want to take you back, will remember the exciting news from April of this year on the hatching of a pair of white-tailed sea eagle chicks on Garnish Island, Glengareth in West Cork. This report by Pascal Sheehy for 6-1 News.
A pair of white-tailed sea eagle chicks are fed by a 9-year-old female just days after they hatch. This is the first time since sea eagles were reintroduced here 13 years ago that a pair of chicks has hatched in County Cork. This is the first time the incubation and hatching of a pair of chicks has been captured live using a webcam erected by the Office of Public Works.
Because of my work, I get to see eagles pretty much every day if I want, you know, and you just realise so many people don't get that experience, and to be able to bring that into people's homes, it's fantastic, yeah.
That was Claire Hardman, conservation ranger with the National Parks and Wildlife Service at Glengareth Woods Nature Reserve. And Claire joins us now with the news that the surviving 11-week-old white-tailed chick is the first female to fledge in Cork in over 100 years. Should I congratulate you, Claire?
Of course, yes, it's fantastic to see another white-tailed sea eagle chick going out and making her way in the wild and boosting the little fledgling population of eagles that we have.
Take us back. This is part of the original cohort of chicks brought from Norway as part of the white-tailed sea eagle reintroduction programme. When was that exactly?
Well, the white-tailed sea eagle reintroduction programme took place between 2007 and 2011. And from those eagles, a pair set up on Garnish Island in Glengariff Harbour. And this year, the female was from 2011 and we had a male from 2010. And they, as you said, she laid two eggs and those chicks hatched in April of this year.
But only one of them survived. Is that the case, Claire?
Only one of them survived, and that's quite common. It's quite common that they lay two eggs, and it's very common that only one survives. Because we had the camera on the nest, and it was the first live webcam on a white-tailed eagle nest in Ireland through the breeding season this year in Glengariff. So we were able to follow like every step of the way from hatching, and unfortunately the older chick, we think, actually killed the younger chick. There was a lot of fighting going on in the nest, and that's actually rarely documented in white-tailed eagles. It's more common in golden eagles that you have sibling rivalry.
Well, of course, they hatch
without a camera on the nest, you just wouldn't see that behaviour.
They hatch out at different times, don't they? So the first egg to be laid hatches out first. So there is a bigger one and a smaller one in the nest anyway.
There is. The first chick hatched on the 15th of April and the second one on the 19th of April. And as it turned out, the first chick was a female, and female eagles are quite a bit bigger than the males. You know, the adult female white-tailed eagle could be up to 50% larger than the adult male. So even at chicks, there's that size difference. So the fact that the first chick was a female and 4 days older, yeah, she definitely had a big advantage over the younger chick. And there was possibly a shortage of food, which played into it. The only nests which have successfully fledged two chicks in Ireland are up on Loch Derg, and there's, you know, a very plentiful supply of food there.
But have these been actually nesting there since 2011?
They haven't been nesting since 2011. The first, it's a long and complicated history of the eagles in Glengariff. The first pair were there in around about 2013, but they first laid in 2014. But they had various bad luck. They fledged a chick in 2016, a male, and that male chick, Eddie, was the first chick to hatch in County Cork in over 100 years. The original pair, both have gone. So this year we were left with, Blue W and Black P.
The chick that thankfully has fledged now, the odds were stacked against it a bit this year because I believe the adult male, the father, disappeared. Do you know what happened there?
We don't know what happened. The adult male disappeared when the chick was only about 3 weeks old. So it was, really at a crucial time because the chicks can't regulate their own temperature until they're sort of 4 or 5 weeks old. So there's no way that the female was going to be able to raise that chick on her own. We don't know what happened to the male. He did have a little bit of form because in 2018 he had actually had a second nest. He had two nests within 5 kilometres of each other, and he was trying to keep both of those nests going. Both actually failed. So there's a slight possibility that he's off with another female. Another possibility is that he was killed defending his territory. We know that one of the satellite tagged eagles was in the area around about that time, but it's also possible he befell, came to a bad ending, possibly poison. But we just don't know. There's been no sightings of him since, so we just don't know what happened.
And you mentioned there that it would be difficult or almost impossible for the female to raise the chick by herself. So what did you have to do? How did you help her?
Well, we decided to intervene. We had actually started doing a bit of supplementary feeding because we just thought that might get the second chick over the line in terms of survival. So, but once the dad, once we realised he had disappeared, we started feeding. So in the early days, there was food being put out twice a day, and huge thanks to the people that did that because that was incredibly dedicated, because back at that time there was still some pretty wild weather to be going out in. So incredibly grateful to them, and also incredibly grateful to all the people that donated fish, local anglers, fishmongers. Photo Wildlife Park were fantastic as well in supplying food later on in the
season. Well, they
had
good news themselves this week because they had the birth of three cheetahs.
Yeah, it was really interesting because the first time I went to Fota to pick up some prey for the eagles, it was during lockdown and it was like really, really quiet. And then going back more recently, and it's lots of people seeing those cheetahs and other animals. So
Well, listen, it's terrific news. I'm delighted. Is this chick tagged itself? Will we be able to monitor it as it goes forward?
Yes, she was satellite tagged and wing tagged. So she has an orange wing tag with a dot on it on her left wing and a purple tag on her right wing. She was tagged by Dr. Alan Mee, who was very much involved in the original reintroduction program. So he came down, Damon Clark from National Parks and Wildlife Service climbed the tree and lowered the eaglet, as she was at that stage, down, and Alan tagged her. So we have the satellite tag on her, so we're really looking forward to being able to follow her movements. Actually, I see this weekend she made her first longish flight. She flew about 8 kilometres over the border into Kerry. So she's still very much around Garnish. We can see that from her.
And is she feeding for herself at this stage?
We don't know. She would still be dependent on the mother. Normally they will stay around the nest or near the mother or the parents in a normal situation for, you know, several weeks, even months. You know, it might not be till November where she completely becomes independent and goes out on her own.
What are you going to call this one?
The Glengariff chick we haven't named, and that was one of the reasons for talking to you today. We've still been calling her chick, but I mean, she's massive, 6.8 kilograms, 2.2 metre wingspan, so chick is definitely not a suitable name. So we're actually inviting the public to suggest names. So if you go on to the Glengariff Woods Nature Reserve Facebook page, you'll see there's a post there with pictures of her from when she was 1 day old to now, when she's fledged, big glossy brown bird. So just suggest a name, and it's nice if you put like a little bit of explanation about why you've chosen that name. There's some fantastic names being suggested already, from commemorative ones commemorating John Hume. Two men very sadly died in Glengariff last weekend, some people mentioning them. Her Norwegian heritage, because of course her mother was Norwegian. She's born in the Rebel County, so whatever inspires
you could
people.
Be going around in circles for an awful long time and offending an awful lot of people by choosing the wrong name, if you know what I mean. Anyway, look, we wish you well with it. You can text with your suggestions to 51551. Try to keep them politically correct. Claire, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Great to talk to you all, and enjoy the rest of your summer.
We'll keep watching this space. Now, last week we were hoping to speak about gluing birds in France. Now, it's a pretty nasty. We talked about actual trophy hunting, which was bad enough. But then you were mentioning to me afterwards about gluing birds in France. Can you explain a bit about that and what's going on?
Yes. So for a long time in France, one of the traditional hunting methods has been used there to catch blackbirds and thrushes for the pot and to make pâtés and so on. It's about putting glue on sticks, and the birds land on the sticks. They get stuck fast there, and then the hunters come along and remove them and then kill them and eat them. And it's been argued that, you know, this is part of French tradition and this should be allowed to continue, despite the fact that the European Union has banned this practice, except in certain very specific cases where it's very targeted, it's not done in general ways, and it's part of the tradition of an area. Now, the European Commission has finally stepped in and told France that it has to ban this by October of this year, or they will face hefty fines. And the reason that they're doing that is because it's been shown that it's completely indiscriminate. There's no way that the hunters know what species of bird is going to land on those
sticks.
How
can you call that hunting anyway?
Well, I can see how it would be an efficient way to trap birds. You know, it's not done for sport traditionally, it's done for food. I could see how in years gone by, for subsistence reasons, that might have been an important food source for a lot of people who needed protein. Now, today, it's very much a preserve of rich, wealthy people coming out to do it. People are arguing this in France that it's terrible it's being banned because they're saying it's part of their tradition. Well, my argument with that is there's lots of things that are traditional. It doesn't mean that they're good.
People got guillotined as part of the French tradition. Now, they're thinking of bringing that back too.
Well, indeed. Good question. And the thing, of course, is that it's been proven to be completely indiscriminate. So the fact is, birds like song thrushes are declining anyway. So that's not good news that they're being caught.
And could mammals be caught on these as well?
I presume they could. I mean, imagine for especially small rodents, things like squirrels, I'm sure would be caught as well. But it's been proven that many migrant warblers, including some that would come up here to Ireland, birds like willow warblers and chiffchaffs, blackcaps, they're being caught as well. And the LPO, the Ligue pour la Protection des Oiseaux, which is the BirdLife International partner in France, they had hidden cameras at some of these sites, and they saw some of these non-target birds just being taken alive or half dead, even off these off these glue sticks, and just tossed on the ground, discarded like litter and left to die. So it's pretty damning. So the European Commission has stepped in and said that this is completely indiscriminate. It's not something which is going on in this day and age, and they've banned it. And I've told France they have to ban it, and if they don't, France will be subject to very hefty fines. So there's a bit of a conflict going on in France now about the tradition and the arguments about bird protection, but let's hope it stops.
Well, hopefully they'll pay heed. Anyway, you can get in touch with the programme about anything at all. You can email mooney@rte.ie, or you can text 51551.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the web. website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Tomorrow night here on RTE Radio 1, you will have a second chance to hear a documentary from the Mooney Goes Wild archive. And if you haven't already heard it, I can promise that you will be intrigued by this feature on the Swedish scientist Carl Linnaeus. In this clip, you will hear our very own biologist, Terry Flanagan, introducing his students to binomial nomenclature, a classification system formalized by Carl Linnaeus, who was also known as the father of taxonomy.
Now, lads, we want to move on to something new today. We've just finished the study of the cell, and today we want to move on to the organism. That's all of the cells joined together, making the individual. And one of the buzzwords we have in biology today is biodiversity. And biodiversity means variety of living things. And nobody knows for sure how many living things there are on Earth. Some people estimate there could be as many as 15 million different species here on Earth. And to understand this, we need to classify these different species into groups. And we refer to this as taxonomy. Taxonomy is the science of classification. And by far and away, the most important taxonomist is Carl Linnaeus. Carl Linnaeus was a Swedish botanist, and he devised a scheme where organisms were grouped together according to basic similarities. His scheme is sometimes referred to as the binomial system. In other words, it was a two-name system, and these names were in Latin. And if we take some examples, for instance, ourselves, the human, our species name, our correct name, is Homo sapiens, or wise man. And Homo, the first name, refers to the genus, whereas sapiens is the species name. And in other examples, we could think of maybe the frog, the common frog, or Rana temporaria, or the temporary frog, because they only saw frogs at certain times of the year and refer to them then just as being temporary.
That documentary about Carl Linnaeus, presented by Dr. Richard Collins, can be heard tomorrow evening right here on RT Radio 1 from 10 p.m. But now, I want you to listen closely to this animal sound. Any idea what it is? Now, this is the sound of an animal you'll be very familiar with. You may never have seen one. It is the European otter. They have a variety of calls indicating fear or alarm to one another. There's hisses and yelps. Whistling sounds are most often associated with begging or to send out an alarm. But this one that you're hearing now, this staccato noise, is used to alert other otters to danger. A new survey has shown almost 200 signs of otter activity around Dublin's rivers. The study found 196 otter markings across 84 kilometres of waterways, including Main, Santry, Nanakin, Talca, Liffey, Camac, Poddle, Dodder, Owen Door, Little Dargle and Slang. Ross Macklin is co-author of the survey, which was commissioned by Dublin City Council, and Enni Launa was curious to know why they needed this survey.
Hello, Ross. How are you?
Hi, Enni. Nice to meet you. How are you?
This otter survey, it must have been great. Why did they want a survey in the first place?
Well, I suppose Dublin City Council, as part of their commitments to their biodiversity management plan, need to look at the distributions of protected species and habitats. And once they know that baseline and those distributions, it can help them inform the management of those sort of very important sites, you know. With regards otter, because they're quite a cryptic animal, finding the signs can be quite difficult unless you really understand their ecology. And our experience as freshwater ecologists covering 15,000 kilometres of Irish River Channel at this point allowed us to have a unique viewpoint of sort of otter ecology in terms of extensive field experience. So otter signs and where they mark are quite clear to us, given that we walk so many river corridors, including quite unique signs. You know, for example, otter marking crack willow, which I'm sure you're familiar with as a tree, is a beautiful tree, Salix fragilis, which obviously when it breaks and with its fissured bark and its sort of drip line profile often is a perfect substrate for otter to mark. And we discovered
when you say mark, what do you mean mark? Do they urinate on it? Do they grab it with their claws? what kind of
it's
remark
probably a on? Bit of both. And we had a little bit of trail camera footage, and like most of the time what we can detect obviously visually is otter sprint, which is effectively otter poo or scat. And because of the brittle substrate of crack willow, it's an ideal marking outpost. And generally, otter sprint is non-random, that they pick strategic outposts. So they like to mark trees which are prominent. And if you think of a crack willow, hydrologically, it favours the, you know, low down in the bank heights, whereas the alder would be higher up. And what we found is that on rivers where you have a lot of crack willow, like we found on the lower River Lee, that otters have decided that this is a great place to mark. And we found that that was preferentially selected over other trees.
So you knew loads about the otters in Cork on the Lee.
Of course.
So when Dublin City Council wanted the survey, because obviously it's a protected species under the EU directives and they need to have a report every so many
exactly.
years. So when did you carry this one out?
We carried it out in 2018 and 2019.
Yeah, so and it has it just been published recently?
Yeah, now? And published on the Dublin Bay Biosphere website. So if you Google Dublin Bay Biosphere, you can find a report. There's a lovely picture of an otter, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with. So you can click on that icon and that'll take you directly to the report.
Otters are an indicator species of clean water because otters, of course, are top predators. They feed on fish. Fish then are in rivers that are clean with plenty of oxygen in them. So by finding these otters, this would seem to indicate that our water quality in Dublin is quite decent.
It's an interesting one because there is probably conflicting evidence in the literature. From one perspective, some authors say that otters are poor bioindicators. Others would contradict this and say that, like, for example, in our own study, we noticed that otters are probably an indicator over finer scales in terms of when the water quality gets really bad, otters are unlikely to be present. And that's likely because of the absence of trout. So salmonid fish tend to disappear when the rivers go into the poorer water quality classes. So for example, below Q3, which is the kind of middle class, like we all know the sort of blue dot system in Ireland from the
EPA. Five is good and one is terrible. So
exactly.
Three is middling, yeah.
So like when you're in the middle, the like otters would tend to disappear or tend to, they're, at least their marking signs would be significantly reduced when you go below Q3. So Q2 to 3, Q2 and Q1. Why this is probably the case is because smaller rivers have less volume of water and therefore they're more likely to be polluted, whereas the bigger rivers are wider and they have much better pollutant attenuation capacity. People have found that there's a negative correlation between otters and sort of smaller rivers. So like when the river gets very narrow or when the altitude of the river gets very high, you tend to get much less otter signs. So the bigger rivers are always more important for otter.
So the bigger rivers then, you're talking of the Talca and the Liffey and the Dodder,
exactly.
they all have otters in them. But you were saying that you didn't actually see an otter as such. You were seeing the otter droppings, the otter sprint, the black tarry poos
yeah.
that they make and smell distinctive of otter in actual fact. Now, then would that give you an indication of how many otters were there? Do otters mark their territory and then from one sprint to another is that this otter and then the next one is the next otter? Could you give any indication of how many families, how many otters' territories
it's,
there
it's
were?
It's an interesting question and to answer it, I would say that otters definitely more strongly mark breeding areas. So you find that there tends to be an increase in the intensity of marking near clusters of holes. And those areas are often seem to be used interannually. So a family group will continue to use that holt network over numerous years from our own evidence that we've gathered in other studies. So these areas are very important areas to preserve in posterity. But
so how do they work then? So do you have male, female and the babbies, or is it mammy and the babbies and your man? Like, I know it's, you know, it's another species. The male doesn't actually take part in the rearing of the
yeah.
offspring. What's the situation with the otters?
Well, the males tend to be more solitary with the females being more philopatric, you know, so there is
philopatric. Now come on, talking.
Yeah, there's
like
that they hang out. They hang out. They are more, I suppose, fidel to their to certain areas of habitat. Like for example, holt areas where they've bred over the years, whereas the males would tend to wander. So female otter territory would be smaller, their core territory.
And the males, come a calling. Yeah, they come a calling.
So they could be 20 kilometres for a male territory. So what tends to happen as the population is starting to expand, the males will start to wander out into new territory. And that's often when you get road mortalities. Like, for example, you know, roads would be one of the major threats to otter in terms of survival.
Yeah, so this COVID time must have been fairly good at the early stages when there was less traffic than there is now. But the other thing then, of course, is that holts are built in the river banks. So if you have trees, you know, woodlands along the banks of the rivers, this is better territory because presumably the roots of the trees can be used perhaps as scaffolding, like in a mine, to hold up the area for otters. So another reason for having woodlands or riverine woodlands.
Yeah, well, trees are very important, particularly people would, I think, speculate that a lot of holes have entrances underwater and that otters will access from, you know, the river itself. But what I found from walking, you know, extensively in Irish rivers is that a lot of the holes tend to be above the normal flooding river range. So, for example, you wouldn't build a holt if it was going to be flooded under extreme flood events. So the otter holes tend to be high up in the bank. So, you know, on average, between 1.5 and 3 metres above the normal river flow level. On the bank top, you get a lot of alders, and I found that they are very important in terms of holting, that otters often use the roots of alder systems for their holting. So there's all these little pieces of evidence you notice when you actually walk hole corridors, and that's why our study, we use this total corridor otter survey technique where we walked the entirety of the channel. So we started at the M50 and effectively walked all these rivers all the way to the sea.
Well, great. And were there otters in all of the rivers? Was there any river that had none?
Yeah, the smaller rivers, the smaller the river, as I said earlier, the less likelihood you were going to find otter signs. And what you find is that the more north rivers, you know, like the Main and the Santry, had very small, low numbers of signs. And one of the reasons is because they're very small watercourses, and also because they're more prone to pollution because they have less water volume. But what you find in the less important or the smaller rivers is that you can get a lot of marking near the coastline. So otters will venture in from the coast and, you know, wander up the river and say, I'm not going much further, I'm going to go back out. So they tend to mark an area low down, but you don't get that lovely even distribution.
Yeah, because they're coming from the sea. So they'll go back down to the sea and try another one. So exactly. We can all read about it if we go to the Dublin Bay Biosphere website and read about it. And in fact, so it's good news for Dublin because it was in the 1990s, I remember, there was one done and, you know, they found otters then, but not any nearer than Island Bridge. So it's great to see that Dublin waters are able to sustain an otter colony. That was great fun doing that. I'm sure you enjoyed it, did you?
Yeah, I mean, we always love walking rivers, and, you know, walking urban rivers gives you a different perspective than walking rivers in the countryside and outside of the city. So you get to see very interesting bits and pieces, I suppose, when you're walking down
wildlife
the urban
of
river.
All sorts. Listen, Ross, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thanks very much.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Email mooney@rte.ie.
Now I want to talk a little bit about the emperor penguin, which is the only penguin species to breed during the Antarctic winter. Can you just imagine how cold it must be there? The female lays a single egg, which is then incubated by the male, and they huddle together in colonies which can contain thousands of individuals. Together, they withstand the extreme Antarctic winter cold for more than 2 months while protecting their single egg, as documented in the film March of the Penguins.
The temperature is now 80 degrees below zero. That's without taking into account the wind, which can blow 100 miles an hour. Though they can be aggressive during the rest of the year, at this time, the males are totally docile, a united and cooperative team. They brace against the storm by merging their thousand bodies into a single mass. They will take turns, each of them getting to spend some time near the center of their huddle, where it's warmer.
the voice of Morgan Freeman in March of the Penguins. A new study using satellite mapping technology reveals there are nearly 20% more emperor penguin colonies in Antarctica than was previously thought. The results provide an important benchmark for monitoring the impact of climate change on the population of this iconic bird, as they are especially vulnerable to loss of sea ice, their preferred breeding habitat. Dr. Peter Fretwell is a geographer with the British Antarctic Survey and is lead author of the report. Earlier, he spoke with our own Dr. Richard Collins.
Hello, Peter. Are you in Antarctica or are you just across the water in Britain?
I'm in Britain. I work for British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge, and I'm just outside Cambridge in my home village at the moment at home. Oh, so I've spent four seasons in Antarctica, anything between 3 weeks to 3 months, various different places on research ships, in Antarctic research stations, and also in a tent for 8 weeks.
Is it true that if you go on the British Antarctic Survey, you have to have your appendix removed in advance? Is this just an old wives' tale?
We used to do that. This is because back in the 1980s, the Russian doctor who was overwintering deep in the heart of Antarctica got appendicitis, and it's the only recorded case of any person ever having to take their own appendix out. He quite literally took his own appendix out.
Did he manage to do that?
Mainly by feel and a lot of vodka, I think.
And did he survive that?
He did survive it, yes, yes. It's the only time in history that's happened. So for a while after that, we had everybody to take their appendix out, and then we made the doctors remove their wisdom teeth. Appendix and wisdom teeth were the two things that had to be removed, and the doctors did that for a while, but now we don't ask that because I think it's easier to get people in and out of Antarctica as the logistics have got better.
About 11 years ago, you discovered that the guano emitted by penguins, the poo, can be spotted from space, from a satellite. Is that true?
That's true, yes, yes. So we discovered that you can see the reddy brown stains on the ice. Now, the emperor penguins, which this applies to, that they live on the frozen sea, on sea ice. Every year around Antarctica, it gets so cold that the sea freezes over. And the penguins use this platform to breed on. So they never have to come onto the land at all. But the frozen sea should be just pure white in colour. They shouldn't have any stains on it. And those penguins live at that site for about 9 months of the year, and it gets quite messy around them. So they leave behind these large browny red stains. So although the penguins are often too small to see individually using the satellite imagery that we use, then the large poo stains, the guano stains, are quite visible and really give us a good indication of where the penguins are and how they move over the season.
A thought occurs to me. The penguins, or rather the emperor penguin, rather not other penguins, breed in the depths of winter. Now, you have two satellites going around in polar orbit. Now, they are looking down at the penguins when it's totally dark down there, are they not? And how do you see anything?
Luckily for us, although they do breed in the depths of winter when it is totally dark, they actually remain at their colony locations all the way up until December. So typically around the coast of Antarctica, it'll get dark sometime in April. And that's just about when the penguins are turning up to their breeding sites. Of course, it's reversed in Antarctica, so the winter is our summer and our summer is their winter. And throughout the June, July, August time, the penguins will be at their site, but it'll be totally dark. But about end of August, sort of September time, the sun comes back up and the penguins will remain there between September and until December time. And it's in those 3 or 4 months that we are able to actually see them with satellites.
So the satellite passes over and the Earth keeps turning and it passes over a slightly different place each day for several days and then we're back over the same place again. Is that the sort of pattern you count these selected readings kind of thing?
Yes, yes. So we probably get, the satellite goes around the Earth, polar orbiting, and it takes continual pictures of everywhere it goes. And we get pictures of each particular location about twice a week or so, depending upon the cloud. So that gives us a really good indication of what's there underneath us, and we can track things over time. And even if it's cloudy for several days or even weeks, we usually can still get at least one or two images every season.
Do you have to worry about snow covering up the stains?
In some cases, yes. If you have particularly small colonies, and that means that we, or for instance, if they're in the shadow of an iceberg or something like that. So that's why we try and get multiple images of all the colonies, just to confirm that they're there.
Well, now, can you correlate the size of the patch of brown on the ice to the number of penguins that are in the colony?
Not with this satellite. Because of the snowfall and other things, how the penguins move, the actual amount of guano that's there isn't a good indicator of how many birds are there. Masses of guano means there's quite a few birds, but not very particularly precisely. But once we've found the locations where the penguins are, we can then send the really high-resolution satellites, the very high-resolution, which have got sub-meter resolution for every pixel on the ground. We can send those to those locations, and using those satellites, we can count the penguins themselves. We can't find the colonies in that way because these really high-resolution satellites, they don't have a big footprint, and they don't take continual images. You have to tell them where to go before they'll take an image.
Penguins are tracking back and forth over the ice kind of thing. Do you have a kind of roadmap effect where you see the track the penguins are using, traipsing back and forth to their colony? Is that the kind of image you get?
With the very high-resolution satellites, yes, we can. We can see which way they're going because obviously they leave footprints behind them, so you can see their trails through the ice. In some cases, they go out one way and come back another way. So you can actually see where they're going and congregating on the edge of the ice and starting to look at their behaviour as well.
Now, the title of your paper is a very revealing one. It says, Discovery of New Colonies by Sentinel-2 Reveals Good and Bad News for Emperor Penguins. Tell us the good news.
Well, the good news is that there are more emperor penguins than we previously thought. Of course, these colonies that we've discovered have always been there, but we just didn't know about them before. And this means that the population, the global population of emperor penguins has risen. We found 20% more colonies. 11 colonies equals about 20% more to the global population. But that doesn't translate to the population. The population of these colonies is quite small. These new colonies tend to be around the periphery of the breeding habitat of emperor penguins, and they're actually in locations further to the north, which are more susceptible to sea ice loss and to global warming as well. Of course, we all know that one of the future problems, one of the things we're worried about with emperor penguins, is climate change. If Antarctica warms, we will undoubtedly lose a lot of the sea ice on which the emperor penguins breed. And if that happens, then we're going to lose many of these colonies, and that's probably the bad news as well as the good news. So we've got more colonies, but the bad news is that all of the colonies we found are probably quite vulnerable to climate change.
Well, assume the 1.5 degree centigrade rise. What is your prediction then of the effect on penguins?
The 1.5 centigrade rise is probably one of the better case scenarios. Well, we lose at least 30% of all emperor penguins, and probably now maybe about 35% with these new colonies, or maybe 40%. That's if we start to mitigate and start to cut down on our carbon emissions. We'll only get to 1.5 degrees if we do cut down considerably. If we don't cut down considerably and we cross over the two degree rise, then we may lose as many as 80% of all the colonies.
Now, you discovered offshore colonies. This is a new discovery, I understand. Something was not known. Are they the ones that are going to go to the wall first?
Most likely, yes. So the emperor penguins breed on the frozen sea, and normally this frozen sea is most stable around the coast of Antarctica. That's where it's the best, usually, because they need a stable platform to breed on because they stay there for 9 months. But in one or two places around the coastline, there is stable sea ice a long way offshore. And what tends to happen is that the sea freezes and it's around icebergs. So if you think of a shallow area, sometimes icebergs, which are 9/10 under the water, they ground into the shallow and they get stuck there. And then the sea ice forms around them and provides a nice stable breeding platform for the emperor penguins. Some of these colonies we found are a long way offshore. One in particular is 180 kilometres, that's 120 miles offshore.
Well, now, where do you go from here? You've done excellent work and this is a major finding. What do you do next?
Now that we've found these colonies, we have already tasked the very high-resolution satellites to go and take really detailed images of each one so we can count the actual penguins there. That'll tell us how many there are. With the ones we've already discovered, and over the last 11 years, we've actually, using satellites, we've actually doubled the number of known emperor penguin colonies that we have. For those colonies, we've been tracking them for the last 10 years. So we're hoping in the next year or so to be able to publish a population trajectory, how their population has coped with changes in the ice and any warming that's been happening. And really to see whether the predictions, which are particularly bleak for emperor penguins, are actually starting to come true and whether they are actually starting to feel the pressures of climate change.
And this is a sentinel species, after all. It warns us. It's the canary in the coal mine, isn't it, to some extent? So this is very important work, not just for emperor penguins, but for the entire ecosystem of Antarctica. Is that right?
It is. We can see emperor penguins using satellite. We can count them. We can monitor them quite well. Many species, especially around the coast in this zone of sea ice, we can't do that. We don't know much about the other animals that are there. The seals and the other penguins, and especially the animals that live under the surface. And under the surface of the ice is almost impossible to track. But to work out what's happening to the emperor penguins will be indicative of what's happening to the whole ecosystem around Antarctica.
Peter, that's excellent work. Congratulations on it, and I wish you well in your future endeavours. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Let's go back in time to the 5th of October 1962. How long ago was that? I wasn't even born. The release date of the Beatles' debut single, Love Me Do.
Love, love me do.
Doesn't love the Beatles? Who doesn't love Beatles? That's my question for you today. There are over 2,000 species in Ireland, but the one we're looking at today is called the dung beetle, and they are extremely important. In fact, these beetles and the smaller mites that travel on their bodies help control numbers of parasitic worms that affect farming livestock. Terry Flanagan has more on this story. Terry, you met a farmer called Bruce Thompson.
Yes, Derek. Well, Bruce is a dairy farmer on the slopes of the Slieve Bloom Mountains in a really idyllic setting in the Midlands. Now, cattle are affected by parasitic worms and they're regularly wormed using these anti-parasitic drugs or wormers. But the residue of these drugs passes out in the dung, and this reduces the growth rate of some dung beetle species. So Bruce wanted to learn more about this, and he applied for and he got the Nuffield Scholarship Grant. And he's now working alongside Dr. Aidan O'Hanlon from the Natural History Museum in identifying the diversity of the different beetle species on Irish farms.
So what's he doing?
Well, he's actually started collecting, identifying and breeding these beetles on his farm. And when I visited, he first took me on a tour of the farm, not to see his cattle, but rather to see his beetles.
OK, so we're setting a survey trap here and we're baiting it with a bit of fresh cow poo. So we're just going to put a bit of water in it, into the bottom of it, and put cow poo on the top of it. And the scent of it will travel downwind and hopefully bring a few beetles up our way. So we'll set this and we'll leave it for a bit of time and we'll come back to it and see what beetles have flown into it. Okay, we're going to leave that there now and hopefully the beetles will pick up on the scent of it and we'll come back in a short while and see what's come into it. These beetles are also a taxi for paretic mites.
Right, and that's why they're important to you, isn't it?
That's one of the key contributions that they bring to my farm, and that those paretic mites actually eat parasite eggs.
Now, these parasite eggs, these would be from the worms.
Yeah, these would
that
be the
infect cattle.
Yes, the gastrointestinal worms. So we would traditionally use a wormer to get rid of these parasites.
And what you do, you worm the cattle to get rid of these worms that are present because they're parasitic in the cattle.
Yes.
But these wormers, they can have an effect on the environment. So what you're trying to do, you're trying to use a kind of biological control.
Correct, yeah.
And that biological control are these mites.
These mites and the beetles.
And
yes.
the beetles.
Yes.
But
yeah.
if we stick with the mites for a moment. So the mites are carried by the beetles. The
they
mites
are.
Don't affect the beetles.
No. It's a bit like the small bird in the crocodile's mouth. So the crocodile keeps his mouth open and lets the bird clean its teeth.
Yeah, and the bird gets a free feed.
Bird gets a free feed.
Symbiotic relationship.
Correct.
Yeah. So this is
yes.
what you have here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Now, how many of these species are there, these dung beetle species?
There's between 60 and 80 dung beetle species in Ireland.
Now we've just moved down about another 50 metres and you're telling me these are your dung breeding chambers?
Yeah, so these are tents we constructed to breed up populations of dung beetles on the farm.
Right.
So as different species emerge at different times of the year, we're catching them, dividing them into their own specific species.
Right.
And putting them into these cages for,
yeah,
for breeding.
Males and females, of course.
Both males and females, yeah.
I can have a look in. Yeah,
yes.
I can see them.
So as we're collecting beetles in these pitfall traps, we're putting them into their own specific species and putting them into these dung pats. And there's approximately 300 in here.
Right.
And what happens is they find it easier to find a mate. There's a larger competition for dung and to reproduce. So this will bring up the population of that species at a much higher rate than if they were left
on their own.
It's
so simple.
Yeah, it is. So here's a good looking dung pat. We're going to shovel this one up and see if we find something in it.
And you're just putting it into a bucket of water.
Dropped into a bucket of water and we'll see what's... See if we float anything out of it. These are out in hiding in here.
So if there are any dung beetles in that, they will
float
out as quick as possible. Does it take them long to come up?
Now here's one. Here's one little guy. There's a guy I want to show if I can find him. He's called...
There's one there, another one after coming up. See him just there at the top? Just beside that leaf here on the other side? The other side there?
Oh yeah, that's our Rufipi's guy. That's the star of the show today anyway. Another one. So you can see these...
And that's a totally different
species. This dung pat is only 48 hours old. And you can see it's already steeped with insects. I'm just pulling up insects here after insect.
So you're talking on a farm like this, not thousands, probably millions or tens of millions of dung beetles.
I would say so, yeah.
And the more dung beetles there are, and the greater the variety of species, the better it is for the farm.
Correct. The better it is for the farm, and not just the farm. Like, we have to think about the environment as well.
Now, Bruce is looking for help with his study, I believe.
Yes, already he has a small group of farmers helping by collecting beetles, but he would like to expand on this number and have farmers throughout the country involved.
Dung beetles are the farmer's friend, Terry.
Yes, they are. And if dung beetle populations are allowed to thrive, they can help naturally control the very parasites that farmers are treating. So ultimately, he would like to see these numbers increase on farms. Mm. And this in turn should reduce the amount of anti-parasitic medication that's needed to be given to farm animals.
So Bruce, we've seen plenty of the action, plenty of the work that you're doing around the farm. Tell us where you'd like this to go.
Okay, so I have a group of farmers collecting beetles, and it's a case of the more the merrier. Mm-hmm. So we need to figure out what beetles we have on what farms and what beetles we need to work with.
And when these farmers collect the beetles, what do they do with them?
The beetles are sent up to Dr. Aidan O'Hanlon in the Natural History Museum.
And he's working with you on this project?
Correct, yeah. So the beetles can be quite difficult to identify and correctly. So Aidan's an entomologist. So
right, and the beetles that farmers are sending up, they're sending up their dead beetles.
They're dead beetles, yes.
Yeah, we're not sending that live in the post.
No.
So what would you like farmers to do?
So yeah, I'd love as many farmers can get involved in collecting the beetles as possible. So yeah, I'd like farmers, if they're interested, to contact me and I'll facilitate getting the beetles up to, collecting beetles and getting them up to Aidan.
It's quite simple, really. It's just get in touch with you. If they have beetles, they're dead beetles, I suppose they can throw them in a freezer, and then send them on to Dr. Aidan O'Hanlon.
Yes, correct. Yeah. What we'll do is we'll store them for a while and send them up in a batch.
Yeah.
And we'll identify them there. Okay. And then taking it further, where do you hope to go to from that when you've identified the different species that are present in Ireland?
I would love a pilot scheme to be worked to see can a number of farmers together in an area work with increasing the populations of the beetles and seeing what effect that would have on those farms.
So the bottom line is you would like more beetles on your farm, and not just on your farm, but on every farm in Ireland.
Every farm in Ireland. Well, when you think about it logically, more animals equals more dung. More dung equals more dung beetles. More dung beetles equals more food for little birds. And little birds are food for big birds. So it's ecology, really.
It's a win-win situation.
Win-win situation, yep.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. Now, just to remind you, you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. And when you're there, you'll see an appeal on behalf of Birdwatch Ireland. Niall.
Yes, thanks, Derek. COVID has been tough for Birdwatch Ireland, in common with many charities across Ireland. All of our fundraising activities and events that were supposed to take place during the summer were cancelled, of course. We've lost out on membership because of this. Many of the projects, the conservation-funded projects we would have, were cancelled as well, weren't able to go ahead. So as a charity, we rely on public support. We're hoping that Mooney Show listeners, who most of whom would be nature lovers, will help us out. If you go to the website there, birdwatchireland.ie or rte.ie/Mooney, you'll see the link to the Birdwatch Ireland COVID emergency fundraising appeal. We'd really appreciate any money at all that people can spare. It would mean a lot to us.
Yeah, and if you're a PAYE worker, you can get some of it back.
Well yes, that's right. For PAYE workers, we as a charity, we can actually claim back money on any donations of over €250, and people then who are self-assessed can claim that back in their own tax as well, yeah.
Very good. Anyway, Niall, thank you very much indeed. Good luck with that. I hope it works out for you. Enid, thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure,
thanks also. Thanks also to Jarlath Holland, our broadcast coordinator. Our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly. On sound today, we had Tommy O'Sullivan. We'll do it all again next week. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Bye!
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.